for people who are Black, Indigenous, or POC. The deadline to apply is September 6th.
More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of That's No Lady, That's Darcel, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from September 19th through October 5th at Portland State University's Lincoln Performance Hall in Portland. Walter Cole owned the first Portland coffee bar, then bought an old barren wine tavern. He began a drag act that, in 1974, became Darcel 15. This musical tells the life story of Walter, Darcel, and more. Again, that's Triangle Productions, That's No Lady, That's Darcel, from September 19th through October 5th at Portland State University's Lincoln Performance Hall, located at 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, here we are again. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. I'm in the studio this week with Olivia.
Hi, everybody. I'm back.
And Sophia.
Yeah.
Both of them friends to the show. And Olivia is
just a permanent fixture.
A permanent fixture.
Now.
Thank you for being a
saint. Can even say co-host, but we can't.
We can say whatever you want to say.
Okay, then I'm the co-host. Here we are.
And Sophia is the founder and lead organizer of No SROs, or mm-hmm. Student Resource Officers, or School Resource Officers, getting cops out of Portland Public Schools, and a friend to the show.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm back.
You were one of the first guests that I had when I started.
Well, I'm honored.
So thank you for coming back. But we have to talk about the climate strike coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So Greta Thunberg from Sweden is in the U.S. She came over by boat because her carbon footprint is so low. She goes by boat. She's better than all of
you
us.
You could never. Your carbon footprint could never.
She's better than you and you and you. But people are excited by her example, and hopefully she'll give a boost to the climate strike, which has already been called for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's set for September 20th, and in Portland, we're going to have a decent contingent, and it's going to be at 10:30 at Portland City Hall, and it's going to go all day long until 6 o'clock, but we're not going to be at City Hall for what, 8.5 hours or 7.5 hours. We're going to be marching throughout the day. So the itinerary of the day hasn't been released yet in terms of time, but we're going to be meeting at Portland City Hall at 10:30 for a rally point. People will be speaking. Then we'll go across the Hawthorne Bridge and the East Bank Esplanade, and we'll go over near the OMSI area. So people should know about what's going to be happening during the day. Because, yes, it is calling on people to leave work, don't go to school, come out and support environmental justice. So this is from 350 PDX, which is the bottom lining organization that is in this coalition. And it says, in Portland, following the lead of youth from high schools, mm-hmm. middle schools, and youth organizations, we will be holding a rally outside of City Hall at 10:30 to demand an Oregon Green New Deal and an end to all fossil fuels here in Oregon. So the demands are a little bit different everywhere, but that's what they're calling for here mm-hmm. in Portland. And I will have more people on who can talk a little bit about the Oregon Green New Deal, which is sort of coming into fruition mm-hmm. now. And I'm excited to see how that gets laid out. But besides just getting people excited for the 20th, I also wanted to plug that there's going to be an outreach meeting tomorrow that 350 PDX is putting on. That's going to be at 5:30 at Central Lutheran Church. That's at 1820 Northeast 21st Avenue in Portland. So for people who have questions and want to get involved, that's what's going to be happening. That's 5:30 to 7:30 at Central Lutheran Church. And there'll be one tomorrow, and there'll be one next week as well. So I hope people want to get involved with what is all going on in Portland. But more importantly than that, I have Sophia here. And Sophia, you've had a lot to say in the last year. You made like a really big impact already just in your sort of getting into activism because of trying to fight against cops in your schools. But if you would care to say more about why you care so much about the climate strike, I'd like for you to give people a pitch.
Care to elaborate?
Yeah.
Would I care? Right here. Well, coming from an indigenous background, right? Both my parents are indigenous to North America. Every problem that the United States has, every problem that the world has, is an indigenous problem. We hate to see it. We hate to see it because of money. And really and truthfully, this climate strike is most definitely going to directly affect the indigenous communities here in North America, in Oregon, specifically California, where we are right now. There are indigenous communities being lost due to this climate crisis, right?
I know that there's some coordination between indigenous leaders throughout the country with the climate strike, but I don't know if it is as pronounced as it should be, because sometimes climate justice and the fight against climate change isn't always linked with decolonization and with indigenous sovereignty, but I think it should be.
Ridiculous. I mean, echoing what you're saying, they're like inherently connected. So what do you think about that?
How we're are not you? Quite there though.
Yeah.
Like what kind of steps do you think could be taken to improve that relationship or the messaging?
What kind of steps through decolonization should we be taking?
Yeah, through the climate justice movement, because it seems to be coming up short in some ways.
Yeah, how can the climate justice movement do better to fight for the sovereignty and justice of indigenous people?
I think I would definitely like to hear more indigenous voices leading this discussion. It's important to highlight how the climate crisis has affected indigenous communities, and who better to state that than those of the indigenous community.
Well, I know that 350 PDX, shout out to everyone who I know that is in 350 PDX. I will definitely be there. I'll report for Cable on the day so that people can know about what's going on. But the question of striking for the climate is something that is pretty new in terms of what's acceptable in the popular discourse. And it is reminiscent of the International Women's Strike, which we've done for the last couple of years in Portland as well, where the question of not going to school, not going to work, withholding your labor for the day or however long a strike goes on for, as being a tactic. But you've already done that, both of you have. So like the question of shutting things down to get your goals met is one that is kind of controversial. How do you defend it?
I don't think I need to defend it to anybody, really and truthfully.
Well,
I'm
just
a
say
proud, radically decolonizing queen, really and truthfully.
Wow.
I'm proud of it.
Well, I'm just trying to provoke you.
What would you say to somebody who you were trying to get out and they said, well, I don't need to do that. I have to go to work. I have to go to school. Why would I miss school? What is that going to do?
Well, then I guess you make time for what you need.
Mm-hmm. But what would you say to somebody?
That sounds so cryptic.
I mean, really, truly.
We're not trying to roast them. We're trying to mobilize them.
It's not. I don't know how to mobilize somebody who doesn't have the same priorities as me.
Mm. What would you say to them to explain why maybe it should be? There's a lot of people who know that there are issues out there, but they feel like they have no power. And so they feel like, me not going to school, that doesn't do anything. Why would I go and protest?
Have you ever seen Mulan?
Many times.
I can't wait to hear
it. Yeah, I'm excited. Connects. I love Mulan, particularly, actually.
When will my reflection show?
Let your reflection show what you are inside.
No, there's a quote that the emperor says. He says, if one grain of rice can tip the scale, then one soldier can be the difference between defeat and triumph.
Wow. And so we're turning this militaristic metaphor towards social justice action. I love that.
Absolutely.
I think that's great. I think you got it. That's your pitch.
So this experience when you were organizing with no SROs.
Mm-hmm.
So of course you knew the people that were in your classes and other schools or whatever, people your age that didn't want to get involved with fighting against cops in schools. So what was your go-to line to try to get people on board if they were a little bit questioning whether or not they should be protesting?
It's hard to pick out one line. I do remember specifically I took the proposition of protesting and walking out of school. I took it to my Latinx Unidos club. And there was a certain amount of...
That's Latinos United for all of our Anglo friends.
We're getting calls off the hook to ask what you're saying.
Excuse me, what is
Latinx Unidos?
Unidos.
You do need those. Stop fighting against immigration, people.
Whoa.
Okay.
Anyway, continue. What did you take to your club?
There was a certain amount of resistance from then, just for the sake of the fact that many of them had parents that were immigrants or dreamers in their family. So there was a certain amount of resistance to raising attention to themselves. My answer to that was, it was the same when you were a kid. What has changed? You could change it for your younger siblings. That was a good one. Guilt tripping off the younger siblings.
Very smart. Right, your younger brother.
I mean, that's what got me into it.
The cops.
That's what got me into it.
Smart. Okay.
Because my little sisters, I have one little sister. She's the youngest, 8 years old. She goes into a panic whenever she sees cop lights.
Mm-hmm.
Balls up.
Yeah. It's very scary.
And I remember being like that when I was little. I remember not enjoying the sight of police. And I thought, I don't want her to feel like that in school.
So you know about the real world early. That's good. So you're fighting to keep cops out of schools for your younger siblings.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
I'm curious if you perceive, and I'm sure you do, but just for the people out there, what connections there are between your work with no SROs and now your work with climate justice? How are they connected?
A concept.
A concept.
We're thinking conceptually. We're thinking big picture.
Just so that
what does it all mean?
Yeah, right. Just so that people know how you go from your area of expertise to... Now when they see you out at the climate strike, and they hear you talking and see you, going to battle, they're going to say, well, what does one have to do with the other?
Yeah.
I guess it's important to recognize a common motive, I guess. I started No SROs PDX for my younger siblings and for the younger siblings of my friends and my community. I would like to decolonize our community for the younger generations as well.
Right. When you say decolonization, in case people aren't familiar with the concept, you use it day in and day out. It's like part of your brand.
Oh, it's a household. It's a household term.
Decolonization, a household name. She's breaking barriers.
So, for someone who knows it as a buzzword but doesn't really have a concept of what it means, tell them, what is decolonization?
Decolonization, I would have to say, is for me, it's a feeling. For me, it's a feeling. Feeling connected to who I should have been and the way I should have been.
If it wasn't for, like, why are you? Okay. So, a 101 for people about colonization. It's an ideological underpinning that gives reason upon reason upon reason as to why a group of people, a gentry, if you will, from one area that usually is, you know, wealthy, well off, thriving, wants to expand. Goes into an area that is sovereign, already populated, and decides that they're going to make it theirs. And this requires a lot of violence, dispossession, and settlements. And that's what the United States of America is.
What did they call it? They called it the, they had a name for it. They tried to put like a spin on it, like it was their purpose.
Manifest Destiny.
Manifest Destiny, that's the one.
Yeah, they always have to put a spin on it so that when people look back in history, it seems
inspiring,
normal, inspiring.
Inspiring, godlike.
Yeah, and then when you can teach kids in school, like, they met some Native American people. Where they are now, who knows? But they didn't do anything bad.
We don't know where they went.
They primarily lived here. There's hardly any anymore. It doesn't matter. What matters is Thanksgiving.
Yeah, let's have some turkey, everybody. Flash forward to the fall. Oh my god, I can't wait until it's a little bit cooler outside.
Pumpkin spice lattes.
Oh no.
Boots, okay. Leggings, sweaters.
Love to see it.
The Party for Socialism and Liberation gets so much free press from Starbucks.
Oh
in the
my
fall.
God. When Shut things up. Really start to pop off. It's gonna really be good for
I
them.
I mean, when people start searching that hashtag in October, hashtag PSL, I mean, they're gonna learn a lot about the Cuban Revolution. You better be ready for all of those new recruits.
I don't know why they're not using it more, frankly.
I don't know. I mean, I'll go on their Twitter and I'll see like if they're gearing up for it. I think I do remember some comrades that I follow that are in PSL that have like capitalized on that. Well, socialized on that.
Socialized. Oh my god. Oh, I love that. Communized.
So
socialized.
A little bit more information about the climate strike. So people who are just tuning in, we're talking about the climate strike in Portland. So this is being bottom line by 350 PDX, and that's 350pdx.org. And this is for September 20th, 2019, 10:30 a.m. at Portland City Hall. We will be going across the river to the east side via the Hawthorne Bridge. And we'll be having a rally by OMSI where people will be doing some trainings in issues like Climate Justice 101, What is the Green New Deal, Organizing 101, Civil Disobedience, Volunteer orientations, and more. The festival is open to all with art builds, trainings, climate movement orientations, music tents, film screenings, food trucks, and a place to build community and gain skills and knowledge that we need to end the climate crisis. This is in solidarity with a global day of action. So across the world, millions of people are stopping business as usual to take on the climate crisis. Join us And the contact for that is strike@350pdx.org. We will all be there reporting for KBOO. And I'm speaking with one of the young people who has been a leader in the city with Youth Voices, Indigenous Voices, young women, Sophia from No SROs, that's School Resource Officers, that's Cops in Schools, fighting against the proliferation of police presence in Portland public schools. So again, thank you for that work. And how do you see September 20th? So if the action is successful, then what will be the next step if we have a successful action on the 20th, you think?
The next step after the 20th.
Yeah, like what do you think will be, like, what's your forecast?
From that?
Yeah. What should
What should you get out of that day, do you think? And then what's next?
Really and truthfully, the 20th, I don't see it immediately bringing the Green New Deal to Oregon because of Oregon.
What do you mean by that?
Expand. Oregon is a liberal haven, and for you to talk down on it is disgusting. And frankly,
we're a progressive city with progressive values.
Oh, wow. I mean, the gays are thriving for sure.
The gays are thriving.
As long as they're millionaires.
Yeah, the millionaire gays. Yeah.
Oh, and as long as they have a Black Lives Matter sign in their yard.
Everything's okay. Don't pay attention to the Nazis. Look at these yard signs. Yeah.
We have rainbow flags.
You're telling me there's Nazis in my town when I have a Black Lives Matter sign in my front yard?
Impossible.
The two cannot coexist. In Oregon? Dear Lord.
I'm thinking about, so I know that the Oregon Green New Deal, which again, next week we'll be talking to some people who are involved in writing the Oregon Green New Deal and putting it forward and trying to push it, because in Oregon we do have a more vulnerable legislature, and governor. So the question of how the Green New Deal, which of course is being popularized by the hour by some of the people that are running for president right now that are championing the Green New Deal, at least in their rhetoric, and at least one of them means it, but that's not what the show's about today. But in Oregon, what the Green New Deal can look like here is up to us. So 350PDX is trying to set the standard for what activism for something like the Green New Deal will look like. So the 20th, I think, will be a way to test to see what their forces look like and how the story is beginning to be written by people in the media, and then how electeds and people in power respond to it, so that 350 and a lot of the other organizations who are putting it together, which, by the way, it's not just 350PDX. I don't just want to talk about them. Also, the Center for Sustainable Economy, Columbia Riverkeeper, the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, Portland, Extinction Rebellion, Jobs with Justice, OPAL, a lot of people and more are helping to make this day happen. So this is going to be a way to test what the possibility of fighting for this kind of climate justice will look like in Oregon. So I think it's a way to at least start.
Yeah, that's what I mean when I say I don't think it'll immediately bring action, but I do think that it's, like you said, it's a good start. It's a catalyst of sorts for what is to come, or hopefully what is to come.
So you talk a lot about your political views on your social media, which, by the way, if you can plug it, you can, if you want people to follow you.
Yes, I will.
Keep that mystery. Well, I'm letting
anyone, she doesn't do anything.
Know me by the voice. That's all you guys need.
If you want more, you can go in the KBOO archives and listen to the interview that you and Sarah
Steele.
So Sarah,
who's at Howard right now, guys.
Congratulations
to Sarah Steele
in DC. Amazing.
All the way out there.
So when y'all came on the show, you really did a great job, and we had a really good response, probably the best one actually, because people get excited about young people getting involved in the movement, mm-hmm. because the older you get, sometimes the more tired you are, and if you're younger, you have a little bit more energy,
a little drive.
So on your social media that you don't really want everybody to know, you you put a lot of material out that is pretty radical, and I'm wondering, how do people your age, who to us, well to me at least, seem apathetic, seem not woke, seem like they're not in the movement like I wish they were, but they respond well to the stuff that you publish? So how are you able to like get to some of the people who some of us have a hard time getting to?
Well, I gained this knowledge through, sadly, experience. Lived on a reservation, was not a fun period in my life, so to speak. It was wonderful being around, you know, my community, but as I said, Indigenous problems are everyone's problems, or they should be everyone's problems. Mm-hmm. The reservations are not worthy places of the people who live there. Bad conditions. You can't drink the water. You can't swim in the water. There's landfills on certain reservations. There's oil rigs on certain reservations. It's a food desert.
Mm-hmm.
Most people live off commods, which, if you don't know what commods are, they're government-issued 5-pound blocks of cheese and flour with weevils in it.
What's a weevil?
A weevil is a little bug that feeds on flour. Just feeds on the starch and flour. Yeah.
So what, do you have to sift it out?
I mean, I did not. My stepmom, yeah, she sifted it out. I'm not eating that weevil bread. No.
Yeah.
Dear Lord, no. So when I came here, there was so much opportunity, right? Amazing opportunity, and nobody was like doing anything to, like, you know, like if I had had the platform to change things in my community, I would have, of course, but like I can't, you know. There's just so many other things that you have to focus on, like surviving. So when I came here, I was
like, oh my god, why isn't anybody doing anything?
Exactly. I was like, this is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling me I can, if I want to do something, if I want to bring attention, I can just not show up to school and say I don't want to do it because of this.
Yeah.
You're telling me I have that right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have that right on a reservation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't.
Yeah.
And so when I got here, and there was such an amazing crowd in Portland. As you said, Portland is a liberal, you can't see my quotation marks, liberal
people city. It's something that people, that is not liberal. People
it's
think
a
it
joke
is.
At this point. Yeah. Well, actually, it, not to everybody, but to many people in the know, to say that Portland is like a liberal haven is you're clearly joking.
You must be.
You have to be. I mean, unfortunately, like maybe it isn't too radical to say Portland is a liberal city, considering the climate that other cities of the U.S. are in.
Yeah, but we. Our country is a dystopian nightmare right now. So to have one place that you hold up as like, oh, isn't this so nice? We're not descending into total reaction.
This place isn't completely terrible.
It has progressive elements, and we can be honest about that. But it feels very silly to be proud of, I'll say, genuinely progressive, because liberal is not the right word, and that's the second part of the joke. To be so proud of like the progressive elements of your city when like the city you live in is also like ground zero for like Nazi, like Nazi
fights in the streets.
Yeah, there's actual, like there are days where people like are like, oh, I don't know if we can go get brunch today, Kelly, because the Nazis are out. I don't know if it's safe to go through downtown. That's wild. Somebody recently was talking to me about like similarities that they were hearing about and reading about between Berlin in the 1930s and Portland now. Like, it's not cute. It's not fun. Continue. But yeah, that Mm-hmm. We should be unpacking that a lot more than people sure. are.
I was reading on Twitter about San Francisco mm-hmm. and that they have voted, or some of the power players in San Francisco have voted to declare the NRA, the National Rifle Association, to be a hate group. And I follow a lot of very shady gays on Twitter, some very just mean, frankly, but you know, funny on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You can be mean on Twitter and be very popular because you're being really quick-witted and people yeah. like that. So anyway, it was about San Francisco trying to make itself more safe, but
for who?
That's the problem, is that San Francisco has been completely taken over by the multimillionaire and billionaire class that use it as their mm-hmm. playground. So okay, so let's say you do get some local ordinance passed. Who are you protecting? You're protecting people who need the least protection. San Francisco, of course, also a place where a lot of politicians go to and take pictures when they want to show how gay friendly they are. But
meanwhile, there's people on the street 10 feet away from where you took that picture.
Yeah.
And every 10 feet from there.
And they might be gay, right? Like, these might be the previously housed people of San Francisco who are gay and made the culture that you go to celebrate, but they've been priced out.
That's what we call identity politics from above.
Oh, talk about that.
Oh, my goodness. Okay,
to expand on that?
Expand on that. Well, people in the socialist communist community love to rant and rave about identity politics, and there's truth to it, but it's not where people think it is. It's not that it's so politically wrong and unintelligent to be attached to your marginalized identities. It's that holding on and being reductionist in how you orient to racial identity, to sexual identity, to gender identity, can be exploited by the ruling class. Because if it really is just that you're experiencing all of these things because of your race, sexual orientation, gender, and there's no nuance to it, and there's nothing that's not intersecting with anything else, then politicians can go to San Francisco and take pictures with gay people and say that they're connected to the gay community and they're connected to that marginalized community. And that has to be enough, because we said that all of this is happening solely based on your identity. And in no way that's intersecting, in no way that's oriented to class, and in no way that's connected to people who have less privilege than you. And that's identity politics from above. Politicians exploiting the attachment to our identity that people have, which is genuine, but they can play off of it and do stuff like that.
But identity politics from below means?
Means, I think, people having an actual understanding of the nuances that oppression can have based on different identities you have. Basic, like, intersectionality, like we all like to talk about, right? Like, being
shout out Kimberly Crenshaw.
Thanks, Kimberly. More like Kambahi River Collective. Like,
oh, shots fired.
Shots.
No, it's all in the same lineage. We don't want to do that.
No, yeah, whatever. whatever. But like, it looks different to be Black and trans and poor than it does to be like white and gay in Portland and poor. Like, and that's not to essentialize those experiences or say that they are just the same across all these different identities, and that if you have this, then you're more oppressed than this person, and that's a constant. It's to say that it's important to know the various ways that capitalism and colonization manifest themselves and what all these different kind of oppressions mean across different identities and the history behind that oppression for different kinds of people, so that we can effectively smash it and replace it with something that is comprehensive. That to me is identity politics from below.
Well,
beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I felt good about it.
I want to also point out the other element is that when people who have a critique of identity politics talk about it often. It's not felt as supportive or constructive. It usually is felt as antagonistic.
Yeah.
Almost like you don't want to talk about any issues that don't pertain to you.
Yeah.
Or worse, ones that particularly exclude you.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're talking about racial oppression and you're white, you may actually not want to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. So that's how often it is felt,
mm-hmm.
especially by people who are new to the movement. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of this. So Olivia and I have been organizing together for 5 years.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've seen when we're out trying to recruit is that people can sometimes feel put off by some of our good comrades who I know are trying, but who don't have a sufficient response to questions and comments and concerns that are raised by people from marginalized communities and almost seem as if they're like shrugging off the concerns of people who their primary motivation for fighting for social justice or caring about social justice is one that is not based in the classic antagonism between labor and capital. But that's not the only part of politics, comrades. It's not. So get better.
Comrades. Yeah, I mean, I've definitely heard the refrain in spaces that I organized in for a long time of like, well, the politics and the issues should just speak for themselves. If we show up in the right place at the right time and the right people are there, and they hear what we have to say, if it's good, then they'll be inclined to it and they'll join us.
Yeah, just like Jehovah's Witnesses.
And if they're not joining us, then we're doing something wrong, which, like, no, maybe people actually have something to offer you. And maybe it does matter that there aren't any brown or black people in your organization.
Oh, my.
Okay. That's a subtweet.
I'd retweet that subtweet.
I would. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Wow. two retweets.
You're going viral.
Yeah. Congratulations. Oh my gosh, this is amazing. What do you think about all of this? You are a young organizer in Portland. I'm sure you have to interface with your white counterparts, comrades. Mm-hmm. In interesting ways, a lot of
times. Do people that are as young as you use the word comrades? Do I need to stop using that word? Mm-hmm. I read a hot take about this recently that we need to let go of the term comrade.
I like the term comrade. I'll bring it back for you.
Thank you.
Bring it back. Bring it to the youth. Don't tell them that we told you.
The youth.
No. I definitely experienced a lot of that in the No SROs movement. There was a lot of, like I said, resistance from young people of color, and a lot of that has to do with safety.
Mm-hmm.
The safety element of, you know, if you're black or brown or gay, this, that.
Yeah.
Right? There is a certain resistance because you're already
targeted,
slightly ostracized, especially in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Being young, you know, it's a vulnerable state. Your brains are just don't know what to make of something different.
Yeah.
Wow. And then mix that with white fragility of white youths.
Yeah, white youths.
White fragility.
Oh, the white fragility is
That? Robin D'Angelo. She's from Seattle. I know her. She came up with the term white fragility. We'll talk about that.
Oh, really?
Go on.
Wow, famous.
We love that. Thank you for that. Love that term. White fragility mixed with young age is almost just vile. Because they don't know, they don't realize they're fragile. They don't realize it. They only know the white fragility that's been passed down onto them from their, you know, their parents or whoever raised them, taught them their ways. And then being young, you know, stubborn, not understanding, well, what are you talking about? What are you talking about?
I'm not responsible for this.
Yeah, this is not.
Stop trying to make me care. I'm not responsible.
This is not concern me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a lot of that. There was a lot of also I want to say not over active but a little too eager to support for certain reasons. You get a lot of Black Lives Matter. You get a lot of that.
like savior complexes?
Yeah, a little bit.
What do you counter that with? Because that's something that I see a lot too. And it's like, it's grating, right? It gets on your nerves when there's like a white person who's like involved and in the movement. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, it's just not clicking with you. Like,
it's just like, I see that you're trying to be supportive, yeah. But why does it feel...
Yeah.
Why does it feel like you're talking down to me?
So what's the
why
right...
Why does it feel like you're giving me table scraps right now?
So what's the right way as a white person to engage in the movement then? To not have a savior complex.
I'd say to speak when spoken to.
Whoa, yeah. Is there a way to engage where you can be like, where you can form your own ideas and take up space without having that? Or is it just fall back until people need you?
I'd say for white peers and white community, it would be just to fall back.
Mm-hmm.
Until I need you.
Mm-hmm.
And I do need you.
How's your track record with that?
I haven't missed anybody.
Wow, shady.
The door is closed, as Nene said.
Thank you,
about
next.
Portia, the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Oh my goodness.
We love Nene.
Oh my God. I think this might be the first time I've come out as a watcher of the Real Housewives on this show.
Oh, really?
The news is out.
We're trying to give the real vibes. I love the show The Real. And that's what we're trying to turn this into.
Well, I mean, the thing about the Real Housewives, and this is, you know, my little hot take theory, is that
they're so comical.
You're watching the decline of society in real time because these people are rich, or at least they're married to people who are rich,
mm-hmm.
and the show is full of opulence, and you're seeing that these people are absolutely miserable. Can't help but to tear each other down, have horrible views on everything you can ever imagine socially.
But they throw some fantastic themed parties.
And that's about it.
I don't watch The Real Housewives, but the one thing, I know some of the people, the thing I've taken away from it is a meme that Alyssa showed me.
A meme.
Where it's Nene Leakes. She's going to, what's the woman's neighborhood? She's going to like the neighborhood of somebody who's slightly less rich than her.
Oh yeah, this is when Cynthia and Peter opened up their new bar. It's called Bar One in Atlanta.
And it wasn't in the most idyllic area, I guess, for Nene. And she's walking out of a car. And the way I first saw this meme, it was captioned like, when you have an iPhone and you get a green text. And
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote local hip-hop and R&B artists with an emphasis on showcasing artists that identify as Black and POC, LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities.
Oh my God. Yeah, I thought
again,
it was like
that's
music,
Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th.
And the meme was captioned, when you're an iPhone user and you get a green text, and it's Nene Leakes walking into this like slightly like less wealthy neighborhood. In her neighborhood, and she's walking around just going, "Oh, the ghetto! Oh, the ghetto! The ghetto!" Just like to buses passing by, walking down the street. Oof!
Yeah, it's a really good example of how far removed
the ghetto
people with a little bit of money are. So, like,
even when they're Black and brown.
Oh, Atlanta is the mecca for this. They call it Black Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
but all the trappings of Hollywood are there.
Yeah.
And chief among them is like a very intense social hierarchy based on class. So if you're not making a lot of money in Atlanta already, people don't like you as much. They don't want to get to know you. And you've got to fake it till you make it. And a lot of people die in debt and destitute because they're trying so hard to make it seem like they're not in poverty or they're not ordinary working people, but they're successful Black entrepreneurs. And it's like, I think it's fine to be a worker. But in Atlanta, that's not the ethos. It's a big problem.
Yeah.
There are people languishing in poverty that are really depressed and sad in Atlanta because they're trying to make it and they can't, because that's how it goes.
Just like Hollywood. Replicating white norms.
So we got a call from Tim, and thank you to my producer who came in and dropped the note, who says that Portland is indeed more progressive than other cities, which is why it becomes the target of neo-Nazis. It's one of the cities that will stand up against racism and white supremacy. And I think that's true. It's already happening. True, yeah. So shout out to everybody who was out with us recently, August 17th, with popular mobilization, turning people out to confront the far right. Mm-hmm. And the day was mixed because the people on the far right were allowed to cross a bridge and march openly, banners flying very proudly. Everybody can see them. And then once they were able to get to their destination, the police blocked the anti-fascist protesters from being able to confront them. And it was a mixed day. I wouldn't say that it was ideal, but what was great about it is that Portland did and does stand up against racism and white supremacy. And I think it's important that while, yes, one of the reasons that Portland gets targeted by Patriot Pair, Proud Boys, and things like that is because it's more of a progressive city and it has more of a progressive image. But there's, of course, the other side of that is that this is a hotbed and has been for more than 100 years for where you go if you are a far right racist and you want to start over somewhere new.
Yeah,
you can go out to Oregon. That's how the place was settled.
Yeah, so that analysis is missing that piece.
Their grandkids and great grandkids and great great grandkids are raised in that culture and they live among us.
Yeah, no, it is certainly that fascists enjoy coming to target Portland because it is progressive in many ways in terms of gender, sexuality, environmental issues, absolutely more progressive. But it is also like, for how progressive people love to champion it as being, it is the whitest major city in the United States. And that is because of a history of white supremacy. So it's not circumstantial and it's not just a reaction to being so progressive. It is historic.
I think it's more of a reclaim type of, it has a more reclaiming energy when they come. It's more like, oh, don't get too progressive now.
Yeah.
We're still here. We still founded this city.
Yeah, it's supposed to be White Haven. And if you and you don't even have to look that far or read that far back, because I'm from Oregon, and if you step two shimmies out of the city limits, it feels
shimmies.
I heard you say that the other day and I thought it was very good. Yeah, shimmies. You were saying it in shimmies. A really shady way, so I'm not gonna repeat how you were saying it.
I'm sure it was my grandmother, God rest her soul, coming in to say hello.
But if you step the second you're anywhere else, it feels like it was built by a bunch of white supremacists. Like,
isn't there town still in Oregon with like a those 24-hour calls where like if you're a black or brown person, like you're not supposed to be there for more than
sundown towns.
Yes.
I don't because think, when I don't think they announce it at their local city hall, but I think everybody knows
what I've known it to be true is that they were on the books into the early 2000s, but they could still be on the books. I mean, call and let us know. But yeah, I mean, there's there's still towns where you will see full Confederate flags on 40-foot flagpoles. There are still full, like, the only places I've been in this country, Oregon's the only place in this country where I've fully been followed in a store. Oregon is, or black, like, Darnell Bruce was run down.
Larnell Bruce.
Larnell Bruce was run down in Gresham by a white supremacist. Like, I know people who grew up in towns where they saw white supremacists marching in the streets before all of this stuff popped off, like, when they were children. Oregon is still fully a white supremacist haven. And if you're anywhere besides Portland, that feels true. Everywhere else is red. Like, so Portland is progressive
to an extent.
To a specific extent.
Yeah. To almost to the same, like, it reminds me of, like, you know, when like some deluded women want to be like, I'm not like other girls.
Oh, are you talking about the I'm not like the, I'm the not chill like girl phenomenon?
Yeah, I'm not like other girls.
Organ is the chill girl.
I'm not like
girl.
My grandparents. I'm not a Nazi.
Oh my goodness.
I like gays. I'm not like other white people.
Oh, someone should tell her about all of the gay Nazis, actually. Whoever that imagined chill girl you're talking about.
Really out
oh my
here.
God. That's so
I have a Black Lives Matter son. I'm not like other white people.
Whoa.
I'm not like my grandparents.
Not like other whites.
I also want to say to everybody that has a Black Lives Matter yard sign, I have one. Like, it's not, we're not making fun of people who have them. It's just pointing out the fact that in the whitest metropolitan city in America that's rapidly gentrifying,
yeah,
one of the things that breaks the hearts of a lot of Black people who have to, you know, come back into Portland after they've already been pushed out and they're looking at their former neighborhoods that they can't live in anymore because they've been gentrified. And they, Black people, have been replaced with houses that have Black Lives Matter signs. And the houses are renovated, the lawns are nicely kept, and there are white people inside.
And it is mostly in those neighborhoods where that have been most horrifically gentrified. There's a wonderful sign two blocks away from my neighbor, from my house. Wow. Yikes, shouldn't have said that, whatever.
Well, then we can move on, actually.
Oh, I want to say it.
Okay,
because it's special. Right. It's near my house.
Well, the sign, there are a thousand of these signs all over the place.
This sign was recently put up for the Mississippi Street Fair, because the Mississippi District is one of the most horribly gentrified areas. And it says, how many Black families were displaced for you to be here? And I love
The Ori Gallery.
Over the Ori Gallery. Shout out to Britton Washington. PDX Equity in Action put up that sign.
I love Britton. Britton, come on the show.
And I always stop to take a picture of it. Like, I've never seen it before whenever I walk by it, so that I can watch white people near me look at it and get a little uncomfortable. It's just fun. I don't even think it's that politically wild to do that, to take the picture and to watch them go. I just like to make them uncomfortable and see what they think.
Sometimes I like to say, this is my land.
Oh, I mean, fabulous.
Or like if I'm walking down the street, right, and I see a white person approaching, I won't move. I'll stop in my tracks, because a lot of times I have been bumped into because they have no intention of moving.
You got to get some spikes on your shoulders.
So what I've been doing
like
is I've been stopping in the middle, right? And then if they get mad, I say, this is my land.
Oh, yes.
Gotten several perplexed looks before.
That's one of the things that I feel like the white left, like even like socialist communist right, are still very far away from reconciling, is like, we're gonna need to do something different in terms of like arrangement of land, like
decolonization.
Yeah, it's not just
some leftists are weak on decolonization.
Extremely weak. It's not brought. I mean, you think that you can just redistribute the wealth, like the wealth, and then indigenous people are just going to be okay?
That's
like,
not going to lift the car spear.
Like, baby, you're going to have to, you might need to move.
Yeah.
Like, actually.
You might need to go back to your own continent.
And that's a question. And it's not ever taken up.
No.
I should not say that. It's taken
up. Not nearly enough.
Not even close.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most important points here is for people who have mixed feelings about decolonization, about turning land back over to indigenous people to create sovereign systems of governance, which I think they should be able to do. People get a little bit frightened by that. And I say, I'm pretty sure that indigenous people will be much more kind, generous, magnanimous, and safe for you, no matter who you are, no matter how white your skin is. I'm pretty sure indigenous people would be much more kind to you than
the white people who are already in the country right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, don't be afraid of decolonization. Because I think that it actually means that we're all going to probably live a lot better.
I mean, we're going to live longer because the earth might stop dying for a hot second.
Indigenous people are always at
she
the,
said,
indigenous people can't are always
see my,
at
you
the
you can't
forefront
see my face, but my face
every,
went and a oop.
And a oop.
Oh, was that Jasmine Masters? Yeah. Shout out Jasmine Masters.
I saw a meme the other day that was like 20 British girls in like school uniforms sitting in a circle saying, and the caption was every woman with one gay friend.
The girls and the gays.
Just for context, so people can know what we're talking about.
Every straight woman with one gay friend, specifically.
Jasmine Masters is a drag queen who was on RuPaul's Drag Race.
I don't know.
Right?
I just know that video.
She makes a lot of content online, and one of the things that she did that went the most viral was when she learned something shocking, and she was very emphatic in her face, and she said, "And I ooh."
That's not why. Do you want to say why?
No.
Okay.
Do you know why?
No.
Oh, you don't know.
What is the background?
Oh, she had just. Can I say this on the radio? She had. Just
maybe don't use curse. The scientific
she pinched
term.
Herself. She pinched her testicles.
Oh, okay.
And she said, "Ow!" And then the rest of the video is her going, "I just pinched my balls."
Oh no!
And then she just kind of stammers, and then she turns.
I should know that. Okay,
it's very good. So because she's going off on this rant about something completely different.
Just rants.
Yeah.
Okay. And her face froze.
Yeah.
So shout out to Jasmine Masters. If you ever come to Portland, you can come on the show. I would love to hear like what she's got to say about politics. Does she ever like say anything?
You know
about
her than I do.
I imagine that she has mixed consciousness, like so many queens do.
Yeah, I mean that's what I figure too. I feel like I don't know, like when you're any space where you're trying to ascribe to a pretty high level of like beauty standards and standards that we're supposed to be showing a level of wealth, you're going to have mixed consciousness.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. But some queens do a really good job.
Yeah.
Shout out to the House of Flora and the House of Ada.
Yes.
Because they're very politically active. They were at Pop Mob and performed as part of the anti-fascist mobilization, and they vogued on stage.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that the movement is actually making people have to just be better and do better and be in solidarity with all oppressed people as oppressed people. But that's just not that doesn't jive very well with the RuPaul Drag Race ethos, which is, you know, about competition and sometimes open racism.
Competition, voguing open racism.
So, you know.
Transphobia, we love it.
Just ballroom things.
drag culture is a little bit mixed. But I'm glad that we actually got to talk about this, even though it seems like it's not... directly connected to the climate strike.
Or is it?
But
I mean, it is. We're talking about mobilization. We're talking people joining in.
Yeah. If this is where people are at, if you want to talk about drag culture and the Real Housewives of whatever city you want, and just
you
like,
want.
Maybe this is the show for you.
I've liked how in the weeds we've gotten on some random things in the last two shows. I think it's great.
Last week's show was excellent. So again, shout out to Critical Resistance. So
Kate and Ari.
That was an excellent, excellent time. And then also Amanda Hill from Jobs with Justice, my co-chair, was bringing the heat, because when I went on her show earlier in the week to talk about the popular mobilization action against the far right, she was right there with me. So shout out to Amanda as well. And this week to Sophia from No SROs PDX, who will be at the climate strike representing young indigenous feminists out here leading the movements. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator.
This is Olivia Pace, your new co-host.
Thank you. Have a good one, everyone. Good night.
Mwah. Popeyes?
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at KBOO.FM.
The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work, to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle. Every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
Join me every first and third Friday from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. From The Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and political commentary. We will ease your troubled mind with licensed mental health counselor Cheryl Jefferson, political analysis provided by the Prophet of Rage, and calling in from the planet of rhythm and blues, musicologist Professor Soul. From The Grassroots, I'm your host, Lanita Duke, on 90.7 FM, KBOO in Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote local hip-hop and R&B artists with an emphasis on showcasing artists that identify as Black and POC, LGBTQIA+,